Do you remember way back at the end of 1999 when people were scared of the millennium bug? Do you remember that big letdown? They thought computers all over the world would crash because they couldn't cope with the year changing from 19-something to 20-something. And the theory went that because everything ran on computers, planes would fall out of the sky, water, sewage, electricity supplies would be disrupted, satellites and nuclear missiles would malfunction, all because of the millennium bug. And so people stockpiled candles, tinned food, petrol, anything they thought they'd run out of. Or else they moved out of the city, set up alternative lifestyle communities where the collapse of technology wouldn't affect them. And Christians were just as bad, perhaps worse, because some thought it meant Jesus was coming back. Karen's parents, I remember, were at a church where the leaders were preaching about being ready. Preaching about planting veggie gardens and putting in rainwater tanks and stockpiling food. They organised a tin food drive so that they could distribute food once the clock ticked over to people who were too foolish to get ready. Karen's parents tried to just get on with life as normal, putting their trust in a sovereign God who would look after them, but there were well-meaning people from the church who were warning them and even rebuking them for not getting on board. They were just showing their misunderstanding of the future by their behaviour in the present. And in the end, January 1, 2000, they were proved wrong. It was Karen's parents, on the other hand, who were living with the right perspective on the end. They just got on with living life as normal, got on with trusting God who rules over everything. And as much as this is a tricky passage, it's a long one, there seems to be a lot in it, that's really Paul's overarching message here. Yes, the end is coming, but keep the right perspective on that. And that means get on with your life. Whatever your circumstances are, single, married, engaged, circumcised, uncircumcised, slave or free, Paul says live as normal, live in the state that God's called you, don't change. That's what faith lived out will look like. Have a look down at verse 17, it's there in the middle of the passage and it's a bit like a summary verse for the whole chapter. Nevertheless, verse 17, each one should retain the place in life that the Lord's assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. And that's the message for us today too. None of us knows what tomorrow will bring. Scary things are happening. Terrorism, religious wars, financial uncertainty, even visiting a coffee shop is no longer safe. But God, you know, he has the future organised. Chopping, changing, rushing around, altering things, if it's motivated by a lack of trust or a fear, it's wrong. Paul says we should instead show a right understanding of the future by the steadfast, faithful lives we live in the present. Well, that's us. That's a little about our situation. But what about the Corinthians? Well, the first thing to notice there in verse 1 is that Paul is answering some of their questions. Verse 1, he says, now, for the matters you wrote about. And then in the chapters that follow, he goes on to address a whole range of different situations. And behind them, though, there's an underlying theme. There's a whole worldview that shows itself in a number of different ways. Now, it is a little difficult, and theologians have sort of debated this for many years, because you can't really read what their letter was, so you don't know exactly what the issues were. It's a bit like listening in to someone who's talking on the phone. You know, you're on the train and you hear someone talking and you try and work out, well, what's the other person saying? I'm only going on what I can hear. And we only get to hear Paul's side of the conversation. But if we try and project back from what Paul says, it seems like there was a group of people in Corinth who were obsessed with Christ's return. And in particular, what it meant for how they lived in the present. And so one possible reconstruction for how they might have thought went something like, goes something like this. When Jesus comes back, we will receive spiritual bodies. The flesh will be done away with. And since we're living as part of God's kingdom now, the best thing we can do is to get rid of that fleshly, physical, earthly stuff. That stuff's evil, and it just leads you away from God. That's what they thought. And for some, that meant no sex with their husband or wife. For some, it seemed like they were even divorcing their husband or wife. After all, perhaps they thought, there's no marriage in heaven, let's just separate now. And that's getting ready for Jesus. All of these things are big changes because Jesus is coming back one day. But Paul's answer to all of those questions, live where God's put you. Over and over again, it's the same message. Verse 17 we read earlier, but a couple of verses on in verse 20, each one should remain in the situation which he was in when God called him. Verse 24, brothers, each man as responsible to God should remain in the situation God called him to. And again in verse 26, where we get a hint about some of the circumstances. Because of the present crisis, I think it's good for you to remain as you are. Which I think is probably a persecution of some sort. And Paul's saying, don't go rushing around changing things, especially with the situation as it is. That's the way you show your trust for God. And that'll apply in all sorts of situations. Like verse 18, he says, were you circumcised? Don't seek to become uncircumcised. Were you uncircumcised? Don't go and get circumcised. Verse 21, were you a slave? Don't let it trouble you. Notice that. Notice that he doesn't say, don't look to be freed. He doesn't say that. He's not against a slave being freed. He says, if the opportunity presents itself, free yourself. And so what Paul is saying, he's not saying you should never change your situation. Never move house, never change jobs, never have children, never marry. He's not saying that. Sometimes it does make sense for different reasons to change, like if your life's in danger. But I think what Paul's saying is the attitude that you have to change. When you're in a situation, you're not to look longingly over the fence at some other situation and imagine that the grass is going to be greener somewhere else. What that boils down to is doubting that God has called you right where you are at this time. It's really a lack of faith. Contentment where you are is an outworking of your trust in God. Are you content where you are? Or are you discontented? So that's the background for the Corinthians. Let's look at some of the specifics in the different situations. Verse 1, Paul gets straight into the matters they wrote about. It is good for a man not to marry. He's quoting their letter, probably. It says literally, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. That's what a few of the other translations have. And he's probably quoting the Corinthians letter. They wrote to him, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. I think that's a better way of thinking about it because it means Paul's not just addressing the question of whether you should marry, but the whole topic of marriage. Once you're married or if you get married, what it's for and what it looks like. And here's one example of where their warped view about Jesus' return comes to light. Their thinking went something like, when Jesus comes back, there'll be no more marriage. I'll just get a head start on that now. The spiritual is good, therefore the physical must be evil. I'll just get rid of the physical. I'll get rid of the physical side of our marriage relationship. But Paul gives his reply, verse 2. You've got it wrong. He says, because there's so much immorality, each man should have his own wife, each woman her own husband. He says, marriage is not the problem. Marriage is actually part of the solution. Abstaining from sex in marriage won't make you less evil. It won't make you more spiritual. Sex in marriage is actually God's way to help you avoid immorality. It's part of his protection against evil behaviour. It's not part of the evil. And instead, Paul gives us an alternative picture of what God's plans look like for marriage. Each man should have his own wife, each wife her own husband. There's an exclusivity to marriage, one to one. Anything else, any other arrangement, is immorality. it's less than God intended. Right back to Adam and Eve. When you know that your wife is committed to you and to you alone, that builds trust. You're encouraged to open up even more, to become more vulnerable. And as you open up more and as your wife continues to commit herself to you despite knowing your flaws, then you will feel more accepted and intimacy grows. So this exclusivity of God's design encourages the oneness that he intends. But more than that, Paul says the Christian marriage is about responsibility. Exclusivity and responsibility. Verse 3 says, the husband should fulfil his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife. Now remember though that Paul's correcting a misunderstanding. There are people who said that you didn't have to have a physical relationship with your husband or wife. And Paul says, and Paul's saying here that each person has a responsibility to give his due. He says there's a duty that goes with the territory. Now, don't get me wrong, plenty of people, mainly men, let's be honest, grab hold of this verse and they thrust it under their wife's nose and say, see, here's what you should be doing. But that's turning the verse around. That's demanding your rights. And Paul's not talking about rights in this verse. He's talking about responsibilities. He's not addressing the person who is receiving. He's talking to the one who's doing the giving. Each should fulfil his duty in giving. Now, the context is a physical relationship, but the principle applies to all sorts of areas for both husband and wife. Husbands, fulfil your duty. Don't be emotionally distant, for example. Don't grunt when you come home from work. Make an effort to talk. Take the initiative in parenting. That's part of your duty. Take an initiative in the family devotional life. That's part of your duty. If you're not fulfilling your duties, you can't expect your wife at the end of the day will be too interested in fulfilling her duties, even if you do quote this verse to her. And what about wives? How can you fulfil your duty? Here's a suggestion. Offer your submission. Give your husband the opportunity to show leadership, to show the responsibility. Or perhaps don't have expectations of perfection that he can't meet. Be careful with criticism. Don't make the home and the kids your kingdom that he can't enter, where no task he does is ever done well enough. Your husband will appreciate that space. Both husband and wife, to be committed to responsibility rather than rights, discourages resentment building in a marriage. It discourages that sort of resentment at not receiving your share, and instead encourages the other person to serve with gratitude. Responsibility. The third part of Paul's picture there in verse 4 is about mutuality. Mutuality. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body doesn't belong to him alone, but also to his wife. It's really an extension, I think, of the last point. For one person to say, I choose not to have a physical relationship with my spouse, it misunderstands the nature of the marriage relationship. Each partner no longer owns his own body exclusively. There is a joint, a mutual ownership. And that means that decisions that involve both need to be taken jointly. You no longer can make decisions that just affect you. All decisions to do with you also affect your spouse. What you do affects her. Communication, cooperation, and compromise is what Paul's calling for. And he gives an example. I think that's probably the best way to take verse 5. Here's an example of the sort of decision that you need to take together. Don't deprive each other except by mutual consent. I think that's the point. And for a time so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. To have sex or not is not a decision that one person makes. It should be a joint decision, except should be by mutual consent. Well, Paul finishes this little section with a personal note. And he's quite at the front in this chapter in terms of his personal opinions. Marriage may be God's plan to help combat immorality, but he's not actually commanding marriage. Verse 7, if anything, he says Paul, I wish everyone was single like me. Verse 7, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, one has another. Some people have taken this verse to say that marriage is really an inferior lifestyle, that really spiritual Christians will be single. But that is not what Paul's saying, because he says that each man has his own gift, and there are others who have a different gift to him. Which I don't think is saying that the state of singleness is a gift either. I think Paul's saying that the gift God's given him is the ability to be contentedly single without being ungodly. I think that's what the gift is, not singleness itself, but the ability to be contentedly and godly single. I don't think it's wrong, therefore, for single Christians to want to be married. I think that's a fine thing to want. God himself said it's not good for Adam to be alone and made Eve. To want a partner in life, that's a good thing. We shouldn't have to apologise for that. And I don't think married people are being particularly sensitive to single people who would love to be married when they say things to them like, your singleness is a gift from God. I don't think that's being very helpful, because the single person probably doesn't want that gift. The problem comes when the attitude that goes with the singleness is an impatience with God, or when the goal of getting married becomes an idol that becomes above everything else. That's where the problem lies, not with wanting to be married, I think. And another point to make, of course, is that making a bad choice in a marriage partner is a disaster. It's much better to be single than to be in a bad marriage. Well, having mentioned his own singleness, Paul now speaks to the singles in verses 8 and 9. To the unmarried, to the widows, I say, it's good for them to stay unmarried as I am, but if they can't control themselves, they should marry. Notice that once again, Paul's message is, remain as you are. And it's the attitude that's important. Be content. Be content where God has put you at the moment at singleness. It might be singleness for the rest of your life, it may not be. One day it may be marriage. But in the meantime, serve God faithfully and wholeheartedly right where you are. There's a big difference between that sort of contentedness and the sort of single-minded spouse hunting that you sometimes see in Christians. Relentlessly swapping churches, looking for potential marriage partners, working through the guys and the girls at youth group, attending beach mission every year or Bible college in the hope that you'll come home with a partner. Now, that sort of attitude's not on, says Paul. A bit further on, Paul explains why singleness can be good. Down in verse 32, an unmarried person can devote themselves without distraction, he says, to the Lord's affairs, rather than being divided. If you're single, Paul says, make the most of this time in life. Don't desire to be somewhere else. Perhaps at this time in life there's a whole area of ministry that you can do that a married person would struggle to do. Missionary service or youth work. Or maybe some sort of travelling ministry that's available to you. Grab hold of it with both hands, because God's put you in a certain place. Don't look longingly somewhere else. Be content. Well, next Paul moves on to a third situation. A third type of relationship where people are tempted to not trust God. The wrong-headed spirituality said, there'll be no marriage in heaven. Let's get a head start and just get rid of the marriage now, especially since he's not a Christian. Truly spiritual people will get rid of those relationships. That was the thinking, but Paul says no. And he repeats what Jesus himself taught. Verse 10, to the married, I give this command. Not just I, Jesus as well, I think is his point there in the brackets. A wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled, and a husband must not divorce his wife. So there's two steps Paul's foreseeing. Don't divorce, step one. But if that does happen, don't make things worse. Don't remarry. It seems like he's saying the situation is worsened through remarriage. Perhaps even the sin is greater, especially if the divorce has happened with one eye on the remarriage. The breakdown of relationship is one thing, but beginning another is worse. Paul's thinking about what Jesus himself taught in Matthew 19, and Jesus goes all the way back to God's design in creation. At the beginning, says Jesus, the Creator made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they're no longer two but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. In other words, God's designed you to be together. Don't separate. You divorce now, Jesus goes on, because your hearts are hard. But it wasn't God's plan. We were made to be with one partner, two becoming one. Paul's thinking of that same situation. Focus on the one that you have, he says. That's God's design. Don't go looking over the fence to somebody else that you want to marry. That's basically what adultery is, looking over the fence. Look at that nice green grass over there. It's much better than what I've got. Paul's message to those of us who are married is, be content. God's put you where you are. Work at it. So they're the situations Paul addresses. Whether you're married or single, the message is the same. Be content. Don't change just for the sake of it. Don't stop having physical relations if you're married. Don't rush into marriage if you're single. Don't separate if you're married. It's all about the attitude we have to Christ's return, affecting the way we live now. Down in verse 29, jump down there, because in that little paragraph, Paul broadens this application from marriage to all sorts of areas. Christ's return, the certainty of Christ's return, brings a unique perspective for the Christian on all that we do. We should think about life in a way that nobody else does. Verse 29, what I mean, brothers, is that the time is short. We can see that in a way that others can't. The time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they had none. Now, I don't think that, if we just take that in isolation, that could mean something very different from what Paul actually means. But he's really saying there is another perspective. There are other relationships that are going to matter for eternity. They need to be part of your thinking as well. Those who mourn should live as if they did not mourn, because we will see our loved ones again who are in the Lord. Those who are happy, as if they were not. If you're happy with something physical that's not going to last, just keep that in mind. It's not going to last. Those who buy something should live as if it were not theirs to keep. Those who use the things of this world as if not engrossed in them. Now, won't that really separate us from those around us if we have that attitude, not being engrossed of the things of this world? And why should we have those attitudes now? For this world, in its present form, it's passing away. We know there's more to life than this world. Our priorities are more than just accumulating. We're not infatuated by promotions or power or possessions or popularity, because it doesn't last. And we're not infatuated because God has something far better, something that will never rust or disappoint or break. And it's that perspective that means we can generously share what we have now, because we can't keep it. And it means we can enjoy what we have, because we won't always have it. And it means that instead we will work for things which do last. We'll build treasures in heaven. We'll live rich towards God. We'll make his priorities our priorities. His family, his kingdom, his riches, all will mean more to us than our own things. Living in light of the future means faithfully remaining where God has put us and being content in those things. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for that perspective. We thank you for the certainty that just as we know that you raised Jesus from the dead, one day he will return and make all things new. We pray that that perspective might affect the way we think about things now, about our relationships, about our possessions, about our priorities. That we would be people who are generous and grateful and content as we live for you in this world. Amen. We're going to sing, and during the singing of this song, a collection will be taken for God's work in the world. If you are a visitor, this is not for you. Feel free to just pass the collection bags along.